The theme of the talk this evening is bringing our practice into the world. And I want to share some reflections. I'll begin by talking briefly about these challenging times that we're living in and how these teachings that have been available in the world for 2,500 years and related teachings obviously going back even further, how these teachings and practices of the Buddha, practices of mindfulness, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity, wise speech, wise action, whole range of practices of the mind and the heart, are the ideal medicine for what ails us today or the challenges we face today, particularly the stresses, the worries, the fears, and the divisions that, you know, are very much part of our culture and our world in these times. I will also want to talk about how these practices lead us naturally to open our hearts and engage with the suffering of the world, and how they help to provide healing and compassion. That there's kind of, it's a natural outflow or outcome of the practices that, just as we were doing in meditation and we can do in our daily lives as well, in the midst of everything, that these practices of being present for our experience, of welcoming whatever's arising, naturally lead us to engagement in the world, caring about suffering. They open the heart to compassion and to loving kindness. And when I say that, I'm not talking about a particular form of activity. I mean, not saying you have to, you know, political activity or social, but compassion and caring and whatever forms that could take. And we'll talk about that. So that's the third point. And the fourth, I'll finish by inviting us to reflect on a key Buddhist archetype, and that is the archetype of the Bodhisattva. I'll talk about that, think of it as a kind of spiritual warrior, somebody who's committed to awakening, to freedom, not just for themselves, but for all beings. Just that kind of intention of the heart to not just free ourselves, but to free all beings. And it's really a culmination, if you like, of these teachings and these practices. And what I'll argue is that this archetype can be a powerful guide and support for working with and engaging with the difficulties and the struggles and the divisions of our time. So I want to begin at what is really central to the Buddha's teachings, and that's the core of these teachings revolve around suffering. That we suffer when we cling, when we try and hold on, you know, like holding on to a rope and getting our hands burned, getting rope burned, that when we cling, we suffer. And when we let go of clinging, we find freedom. Kind of putting in the very, very simple terms. Sometimes said, the Buddha said, I teach one thing alone, suffering and its end. You know, I've heard that that's actually questionable whether he actually said that. That's all I teach. But that's definitely the core of the teachings, suffering and the end of suffering. That we suffer, what causes our suffering, clinging, the potential for letting go, through the practices that we were doing and other practices, that we can find freedom. And that there is a path, there's a skillful, wise path to finding freedom here and now in this very life, not in some future life or 100 lifetimes hence, but here and now in these bodies, hearts and minds. This is the potential that the teachings hold out through these practices, that we can find freedom. So we experience suffering when we want things to be a certain way, and reality you know, doesn't comply with our wishes. You know, the word in the Pali language, the first language of the Buddha's teachings for what we call suffering is dukkha. Dukkha. It's kind of the images of a translation of a wheel with an axle that's not fitted properly. And so it's a sense of unsatisfactoriness. Things aren't the way we want them to be. And we experience this as suffering. So we experience suffering individually when we want something that we don't have. We experience this as suffering. Oh, I've got to have this, got to have this. Ever experienced that? I think we all have, haven't we? You know, there's something we want, you know, whether it's a relationship or an ice cream or, you know, whatever. There's something we want and we for some reason we can't have it, or it's not wise for us to have it. And this sense of wanting and that unfulfilled quality of wanting. Or when we want a political figure to be doing something differently. Can you imagine that? Or when we're constantly worried about the future or wishing things were different than they are. We experience this as suffering, individual as suffering. You know, when we're worried, oh, how's things going to be? What's going to happen? What's going to happen with my children? What's going to happen with the world? And there's a wisdom in being concerned, but if we're in that contracted place, kind of fearful contracted place, that's the suffering. It's not suffering to say, oh, I want my kids to do well, or I want the society to be, you know, compassionate or peaceful, or whatever. Those are wise wishes. But it's when we're in that clinging that causes our suffering. We also experience suffering collectively. You know, it's experienced in war, in conflict, where, you know, it's on the larger social level, whether it's human rights violations or exploitation of the environment, racism and other forms of oppression. These are collective expressions of suffering. So we suffer individually, like we want things to be the way we want them to. But we suffer collectively. There's this collective manifestation of suffering as well. And in the Buddhist teachings, the Buddhist understanding, these collective forms of suffering have their roots in the individual human heart. They don't just kind of come together that, oh, people are at war with each other. They start in somebody being fearful or angry or greedy, and then, you know, other people joining together. And it begins in the human heart. I remember a great Cambodian monk, Maha Gosananda. Maha means great or renowned spiritual leader. From Cambodia, came to Washington in the late 1990s to support the campaign to ban landmines. You might remember that about 20 years ago. And I remember him standing on the steps of the Capitol and saying, if we are to uproot the landmines from the earth, we must uproot the landmines from our own hearts. If we're going to get the landmines out of the ground, we first have to get them, or we have to get them out of our own hearts, because that's where the landmines come from. You know, the landmines don't just kind of end there. They come out of the human heart, the human mind, the fears they come out of suffering. So just a few words about the forms that suffering can take. One of the most pervasive forms in our time, maybe more so than in earlier times, is stress. Anyone familiar with that? Stress. You know, yeah, there's stress around money, around health, relationships, having too much to do, being insecure in our work, in our job, maybe juggling too many roles, information overload. And what happens when we're stressed is that we're challenged, and we feel in the mind we feel we don't have the resources to deal with the challenge. That's essentially what stress is. In any situation, there's a demand to meet a challenge or a threat, and when it becomes stress in an unhealthy way is when there's this sense that I'm going to have to hold on tightly in order to be able to succeed in doing all that I have to do, or, you know, not failing in this job interview. And so we get tight in that way. So many different ways we can experience stress. And I realized that talking about stress can be stressful. So we'll be doing another meditation in a few minutes. So just a few statistics. And today in the US, 3/4 of people experience physical symptoms of stress. And a similar proportion, 3/4, around 73%, experience psychological symptoms of stress. And almost half of those surveyed say it felt their stress had increased in the last 5 years. That was 5 years ago, and I'd be surprised if it hasn't kind of increased even more. So it's really a pervasive challenge in these times of how to deal with stress, how to respond to stress. And I'm not going to talk a lot about it this evening, kind of a different focus, but mindfulness is a very, very powerful tool for dealing with stress. Many of you might be familiar with Jon Kabat-Zinn's work of mindfulness-based stress reduction that's been around for 40 years now and has been taught in hospitals and schools and prisons and whole range of different venues and facilities to reduce stress, to alleviate stress. Mindfulness helping us to be with the expressions of stress so we don't get caught up in it, that we can feel the sensations, the emotions, and let them come and go, as we do in our meditation. We practice this in a kind of a day-to-day ways. I want to just touch briefly on one of the most challenging forms of stress these days, I believe, is political stress. How many of you have felt any of the following emotions related to political developments in the past year or two? Fear. Fear come up for people? How about anger? Quite a lot of anger. How about blame? Blaming somebody, blaming others. Okay. How about grief? Grief. How about despair? How about feeling overwhelmed? Quite a few there too. How about a sense of separation from others, people that believe differently than you or think differently from you? Yeah, quite a lot of that. How about stress generally around these issues? Yeah. How many had multiple examples? They all come up. And I'm not saying we can have the equanimity to hold all this, and that is what the practice helps us to do. But we are living in challenging times, in difficult times. How many of you feel that the elections next year, 2020, are the most important of your lifetime? Quite a few, okay. There's an article, I didn't read it the other day, but how in the Post, I think, saying that, you know, this is the most important elections of our lifetime, but many, many times before people have said the same thing. So different views on that. So what I want to just touch briefly on is that what is happening in the country and in the world really matters. And it's a natural quality of the heart to care when we experience suffering. We look around us, we hear on the news, we read in the newspapers about suffering, our own, you know, those of others and that of others and of the earth. And it's natural to care and want to do something about the suffering, you know, to care about the tens of thousands of fires blazing in the Amazon, the melting of the polar ice caps, the separation of families at the border, the suffering caused by the epidemic of gun violence. Our natural response is to care. And our natural response to suffering is compassion. It's been called the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. It's an inbuilt response, really, to when we see suffering, we want to reach out. We want to care, we care, and we want to help to alleviate the suffering. But when we ourselves are caught up in suffering, in fear or in anger or in judgment, we're much less able to respond to the cries of the world. In recent years, I've been traveling frequently to the Middle East to help lead training for humanitarian aid workers, and the training are in mindfulness and self-compassion and other qualities. The workers are engaged in the Syrian refugee crisis and other refugee crises in the region. And we remind the aid workers of what we all hear when we're on a plane before we take off. In the event of an emergency, put on your own mask before assisting others. Some version of that. Put on your own mask before assisting others. If we are stressed, if we're anxious or overwhelmed, say we're an aid worker and we're anxious and we're stressed, we're overwhelmed, it'll be very challenging for us to open our hearts fully and to really be an effective support for the refugees and the families who are suffering. We need to pause and touch in to our own inner peace if we are to engage wisely and compassionately in the world. So just as a kind of an outline, a framing of the suffering of the world, of the time we're living in particularly, the individual suffering and the stress and the collective suffering. And what I'd like to do is to just pause for a few minutes and invite you to close your eyes if you'd like to, and just bring awareness to what you are experiencing right now. Notice what's present. As you bring your attention inward, maybe some of the things that I've been raising cause some tightness or tension in you. Just meet that, if you can, with kindness, with acceptance. Whatever's here, difficult thoughts or worries, make space for what's here. And you might consciously send a wish of happiness and well-being to yourself. If you like, you could put a hand on your chest or your belly, connecting with the life that's here and wishing yourself well. You could use one or more of these phrases if it's helpful. May I be safe and free from harm. May I be happy. Just breathing in a wish for yourself. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be peaceful. May I live with ease and with kindness. May I accept myself as I am. May I be kind to myself. Just wishing yourself well. The poet Martha Postlethwaite says, in her poem Clearing, says, "Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is yours alone to sing falls into your open, cupped hands, and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worthy of rescue." So just wishing yourself well, taking this space, creating a clearing in the dense forest of your life, and out of that stillness can come greater clarity and insight with which we can go back into our lives and into the world. So when you're ready, if your eyes are closed, just coming back into the room, letting your attention come back. The key to building a more compassionate, caring and peaceful world begins with each one of us, by transforming our own hearts. So if we are to bring compassion, kindness, care into the world, we have to work on ourselves. We have to transform our own hearts and minds. It doesn't end there. We need to bring our practice, our caring into the world. But the expression of engagement and caring for the world is a natural outcome of letting go of clinging and opening our hearts fully to all that's present in the body and the heart and mind. Share a couple of reflections here. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh, What One Person Can Do. He says that when the crowded Vietnamese refugee boats met with storms or pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. But if even one person on the boat remained calm and centered, it was enough. It showed the way for everyone to survive. So Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen teacher, knew that experience of the refugees and the power of being present, the power of a peaceful heart and mind. And this is from Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's teacher, Thai forest monk, a still forest pool. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You'll see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So it's a simple practice that we've been working with this evening in meditation, just to meet this moment with kindness and without judgment. It's a simple practice, we say, but it's not an easy practice. It's not easy because so much of our conditioning and so many of our habits, maybe habits of a lifetime, involve finding ways of not opening to our experience, of avoiding it or resisting it. You know, if we experience something unpleasant and rather than feel it and experience it, we say, oh, I don't like this, it's too hard. What can I do to get away with it? Let me have a drink. Let me eat some sweets. Let me go shopping, you know, and buy some expensive things, you know, whatever it is that we do to avoid being with our experience. So it's not an easy thing to meet our experience with kindness, with acceptance, and without judgment. So it's a training. It's a training of the heart and the mind, not something we do once or twice or a few times, but coming back again and again, training the heart, training the mind. Some of the most difficult and stressful experiences to deal with, to say yes to, are difficult emotions like fear or anger or sadness. These are often called negative emotions. You've probably heard them called negative emotions because they're sometimes painful and difficult to be with. But they're not really, I don't see them so much as negative. Fear, for example, points us to something that we need to take seriously, to be concerned about, something that's a threat to us and that we need to respond to. These emotions are only a problem if we don't respond to them wisely. So if we don't respond to fear wisely, then they can cause us a lot of problems. The key is how we respond. And all of the practices that we do this evening and in classes and retreats like this are a training of the heart and mind to be open to, you know, what Zorba the Greek called the full catastrophe. You know, everything, the good, the bad, the ugly. The whole enchilada, just welcoming the guests. Some of them will be pleasant and easy and friendly, and some of the guests will be rowdy and difficult and troublemakers, you know, feel like that. And so but we our practice is to meet them with an open heart, with a receptive open heart. So, for example, with fear, when fear comes up, we can take action in response. If we're, you know, if a car's coming towards us, we'll jump out of the way naturally. Or if it's worry or anxiety, worrying about the future, we can take care. We can look at it and say, what do I need to do to take care of things? And when we've taken action, if the fear is still strong in us, we can allow the feelings to come and go. So it doesn't mean we don't do anything, we just sit with it. Sometimes if there are things that need to be done. But we can bring awareness to the sensations and the thoughts and let them come and go. If we don't fight with it or resist it, it doesn't cause us suffering. So if we experience a difficult emotion and are willing to meet it wholeheartedly, then it can come and go, like a cloud coming or a weather system coming and dropping the rain and then passing. You know, it doesn't need to leave a permanent mark on us. It doesn't need to cause us ongoing suffering. But when we don't meet fear or worry wisely, we tend to either repress the emotion or deny it, or we act it out on ourselves and others. When we repress our emotions, when we don't meet what's coming up with an open heart, then they tend to come back, often in more complex and troubling ways. So if something has scared us in the past and we haven't processed it, we can keep the fear alive in us. This is what happens with trauma. You know, something fearful has happened, and we keep thinking, oh, this will happen again, this will happen again. So we carry it around with us, which is not a wise way, you know, of meeting. Sometimes we don't have any choice if it's trauma, but with mindfulness and with self-compassion, we can open and allow ourselves to feel what's here, allow the emotion to come, let it be, and let it go. The spiritual teacher, Eckhart Tolle, said, what you accept, you go beyond. What you accept, you go beyond. If you're willing to open to difficult feelings, difficult emotions, accept them, let them come, let them go, then they don't have their hooks in you. You know, they don't control you. They come and they go. They're like the weather, you know. But as Carl Jung said, kind of the opposite side of the coin, what you resist persists. What you resist persists. When you try and push something away, then, you know, from a contracted kind of, in a contracted kind of way, it doesn't actually go away, because that energy of resistance actually keeps it hanging around. You know, it's like you push it out the front door and it comes in the back door or in the back window. So what we resist persists. And he also said, kind of, that what is not brought to consciousness comes to us as fate, which I think is a very powerful statement. What is not brought into consciousness comes to us as fate. So if we repress something, we don't allow it into awareness, then it'll come. We'll act it out in unconscious ways, and often it will come back in harmful ways. So there's a wisdom. There's a wisdom in these 2,500-year old teachings of opening to our experience. There's a wise psychology in these teachings that have been around for thousands of years that very much comply with what Western psychology is saying, of kind of meeting our experience, learning to tolerate difficult emotions and mind states rather than repressing them, pushing them away, avoiding them. So other practices, as well as mindfulness, like self-compassion, loving kindness and equanimity, can help us respond wisely and kindly to difficult emotions and mind states. So self-compassion, just this quality of wishing ourselves well, caring about our own suffering, helps us to accept things as they are and accept ourselves as we are. It's just meeting, you know, wishing ourselves well. If we're suffering, just as we would with a child who's in pain or suffering in one way or the other, we want to console the child and say, you know, going to be okay. You know, I'm here with you. We do the same to ourselves. You know, just that simple gesture, putting our hand on our heart, you know, just caring about, I care about this suffering. And loving kindness and compassion help us hold in our field of care all who are suffering, including those who are causing suffering. Those who are causing suffering, we don't say, oh, it doesn't matter that you're doing this. We don't absolve them from responsibility. We're all responsible for our actions. We're all, you know, in the Buddhist language, we're all owners of our own karma. But we recognize that those who cause suffering are themselves suffering. You might be familiar with this term that hurt people hurt people. Hurt people hurt people. Those who are in pain and can't hold that pain tend to hurt other people. Hurt people hurt people. And it doesn't serve us to act out our pain on others, but that's, if, without awareness, that's what we easily do. We act it out on ourselves or we act it out on others. Some other qualities, equanimity, helps us to hold the joys and the sorrows, the pains and the pleasures, the successes and the failures, the praise and the blame, with a balanced heart and mind. So all of these qualities of mindfulness, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity help us to hold our experience, be with our experience. And what happens, an outcome of meeting our experience in this way, in the ways that we've been doing this evening, with awareness and kindness, is that we go from being in a contracted, defended, kind of fight or flight place to being open and connected. So when we're stressed or we're fearful or we're angry, well, the state of mind that we're in is one of contraction, of fight or flight. We're in survival mode. We kind of go into a tunnel vision. We're focused on what's threatening to us. We're kind of in defending ourselves. And the more that we open to our experience, the more we say yes to what's here, the more we welcome the guests, accepting this moment as it is, this experience as it is, the more our heart naturally opens to the suffering of the world. The more we connect with others and see our own suffering as not really fundamentally different from the suffering of others. So it's a natural outgrowth or outcome of these practices, of letting go of afflictive emotions, of not being caught up in that vice, you know, not being squeezed by stress or fear or worry. When we open to those emotions and those mind states, letting them come and go, what naturally happens is we connect with others. Our heart opens to others. It opens to our own suffering and to the suffering of others. We see our common humanity, that this pain or suffering isn't really my suffering, but the suffering of life. It's shared by all beings. Sometimes, quite often in the class I teach on Sundays, we go round and, you know, it's a little smaller than this, but we invite everybody to just share a word or a sentence about what they're experiencing. And in that sharing, maybe it's 50 people, just letting everybody put their joys or their sorrows into the collective space, what happens is that there's this recognition, and very easily comes up that, oh, wow, I'm not so alone. You know, this person is experiencing this really painful loss, and this person has just had a grandchild or had a child, and, you know, there's the joys and the sorrows, and when we see it all together, our own experience becomes, we become less isolated, less separated, less alone. And we see that the joys and the sorrows, or the joys and sorrows of life, not so much mine and yours. And so these practices, as well as helping us let go of the stress and let go of the suffering, also help us to open wisely and kindly, open compassionately to the world. And they lead us, I think, in an inexorable way to care about others, to listen to the cries of the world, to care about the suffering of others, and to engage in the world. So what I'm saying really is, the more our heart opens, the more we practice, the more, as a natural outcome, the heart opens, we connect, and we say, what can I do? How can I serve? How can I help? How can I respond to this person or the situation? I mean, we've all seen the incredible devastation in the Bahamas with Hurricane Dorian over these recent days, and just the complete devastation. We don't even know yet what the whole outcome, how, you know, the extent of the loss of life. But I think it. You know, just even seeing that, seeing the pictures and reading about it, what happens naturally is our heart opens and we say, what can I do? How can I help? You know, maybe from here, most of us, what we might be able to do is donate, find, you know, what are the best organizations that are there on the ground meeting the suffering. We might be able to do more. A colleague, a friend of mine down in Florida, is actually organizing teams of people, psychologists and therapists and others, who are going to, you know, be helpful to, similarly, the work we're doing with the humanitarian aid workers, to help support people, in obviously in the material way, people through the Red Cross, but also the psychological pain of living through the 48 hours of this incredible devastation. So there's a natural outgrowth of these practices that we want to, that we care, and we want to act, we want to serve, we want to alleviate the suffering. And I want to finish off this evening by talking about this archetype of the bodhisattva in the Buddhist tradition as really the kind of the expression of our practice when our heart opens, how it manifests in the world, you know. And I wanted to say, firstly, that the word bodhisattva means, bodhi is translates as awakened or awakening. So it's the same word as the origin of the word Buddha, the Buddha, the awakened one. It's actually the same word, or the same origin as our word for a flower, budding, you know, from Indo-European, the budding, awakening. So it's, bodhi is awakening, and sattva is a being, an awakening being, or an awakened or awakening being, a being committed to awakening, not just for themselves, but for the benefit of all beings. You know, one way of it had been expressed in certain Buddhist traditions is of somebody who's done all of the work to free themselves from suffering, but because they care so much about the world and others, they choose to stay in the realm of suffering until all beings have found freedom. So that's the commitment, really, and it's a powerful commitment, a very kind of an ideal kind of commitment, really. And if you hear the bodhisattva vow, one expression of it, and kind of might sound kind of high bar for us, but it goes like this: sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to eradicate them all. The gates of the Dharma are limitless. I vow to enter them all. The Buddha's way is inconceivable. I vow to attain it. So you can see this as an ideal, as kind of as an archetype. But it's not so much we're saying, oh yes, I'm going to achieve all this, you know. What's really important, the point is the compassion. It's our intention, our compassion, the compassion and open-heartedness with which we seek to address the suffering of the world, meet the suffering of the world, and commit ourselves to serving all beings. So what matters most is the intention we bring and the compassion with which we act. A great Tibetan sage, Milarepa, said, long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I've forgotten all difference between myself and others. Long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I've forgotten all difference between myself and others. So what I'd invite us to do is just to think about, you know, this kind of idealized view, but bringing it down into our own lives and thinking about what would the expression of your caring for the world, you know, your caring for all beings, caring for the earth, what is your wish? How would that be expressed, you know, as in terms of engagement, in terms of action? And I'll come back to that in a minute, and I'll talk about certain bodhisattvas in our own time. First, though, I want to mention Jack Kornfield in his book The Wise Heart, a book I strongly recommend. He talks about Western and Eastern psychology. So if that's of interest to you, the kind of ancient wisdom teachings and modern psychology and how they come together. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, as all of Jack's books are. But in his book, The Wise Heart, he describes three qualities of a bodhisattva. The first is that she or he begins by acknowledging and accepting the truth of their situation. Accepting the truth of how things are. Doesn't have to be how we wanted them to be, or even that it's right or just that things are as they are. We might not like, you know, what's happening in the political world, but we begin by saying, this is how things are right now. We might wish that they were different, but this is how things are right now. So the bodhisattva faces the truth, turns towards the difficulties, and shines the light of understanding on them. So turning towards, facing the truth, this is how things are right now. This, you know, the world is as it is right now. We might wish it were different. We might wish that, humans around the world and governments around the world were doing a great deal more to address climate change. And many of us would wish that were the case. But right now, things are as they are. We have to start from where we are. The only wise place to start from is where we are. And this is what we've been practicing today, to face the truth of our own experience, you know, as it's arising in meditation or in our daily lives. Just, okay, right now, what am I noticing? I'm feeling really tense, or I'm feeling calm and relaxed. Okay, notice, can I be with this? What's a wise response to what I'm experiencing right now? So that's the first, facing the truth, turning toward the difficulties. The second is that the bodhisattva works to find peace within herself or himself by engaging in a training or in practices to let go of afflictive states, let go of greed and craving and holding and blaming and judging, all of these afflictive states, let go of them and cultivate wholesome and beneficial states like love and compassion, equanimity, gratitude, generosity, all of these states that really kind of ennoble the heart, that help our heart to be open and caring for others and for the world. So working to find peace within herself, himself, by engaging in a training to let go of afflictive states and cultivate and develop positive and beneficial ones. And again, this is what we've been practicing. We've been practicing tonight, the kind of to see painful mind states when they come up, and in a kind and non-judging way, letting them come, letting them go. And if we don't resist them, or we don't try and hold on to our experiences, they will come and go in their own time. It is the nature of things. It is the nature of impermanence. Everything comes and goes. The problem comes when we get into a struggle with how things are. We want to get rid of it. What we resist persists. We want to hold on to the things we don't like, but we can't hold on. Nothing lasts. So coming into a right, wise relationship to our experience, letting go of what causes harm, and cultivating states that lead to well-being and happiness. So these are the practices that we've already been kind of exploring and working on. The third is more specific. Then the third, the Bodhisattva envisions actions and a path of liberation for herself, her community, and the world, and commits to working for those ends. So this is the kind of the intention, focusing. Say, if you thought of yourself as a bodhisattva, you know, working on yourself, working to let go of afflictive states, accepting the truth of this time, this moment as it is, cultivating positive, helpful mind states, what would your vision of how you would be in the world, caring about the world, caring for the suffering of others, what might you do? You know, it may be a lot of what you're already doing, but does this vision, this archetype, or ideal of a bodhisattva, can this be a kind of a vehicle for each one of us to engage in the world in whatever way serves, whatever way most responds or resonates to our own lives, our own needs, where we are in our life. Jack Kornfield says, envisioning has enormous power. With our vision and imagination, we can help create the future. You know, nothing happened of meaning, power, without a vision. You know, slavery wasn't ended without people saying, this is wrong. We need to change this. You know, all of the tyrannical regimes weren't ended without people saying, no, we want to live in a different way. Look at what's happening in Hong Kong right now. You know, look at the courage of people all over the world standing up. Not that they're always successful, but that over time there's tyrants fall, change happens. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. Ohala, inshallah, may it be so, you know, that bending towards justice. And personally, I find the archetype of the bodhisattva a powerful and inspiring one. And I think of bodhisattvas of our own time. You know, in the Buddhist tradition, two very clear ones are the Dalai Lama. You know, of how, you know, for 50 years he's been exiled from his country. He's seen, you know, monks and nuns and lay people put in prison, tortured, killed. And yet he keeps his heart open. You know, he's often asked, you know, why don't you hate the Chinese authorities for all that they're doing? He says, if I hated them, I would be the one who'd be suffering. Because I'd be holding that hate in my heart, like holding a burning coal. You know, it serves me. And you know, I might share this a quote from the Dalai Lama about our enemies. He says, now as a genuine practitioner of compassion and bodhicitta, these qualities of the heart, you must develop tolerance. And in order to practice sincerely and to develop patience, you need someone who willfully hurts you. Thus, these people give us real opportunities to practice these things. They are testing our inner strength in a way that even our teacher cannot. Even the Buddha possesses no such potential. Therefore, the enemy is the only one who gives us this golden opportunity. This is a remarkable conclusion, isn't it? By thinking along these lines and using these reasons, you will eventually develop a kind of extraordinary respect towards your enemies. It's a very interesting way of seeing it, isn't it? The way he would look at the Chinese authorities and engaging with them in that way. And you could think of it, of there may be people in political life today, who knows, who might press your buttons and kind of like you feel resistance. And can this be a place of opening your heart too? So the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, who I've mentioned or quoted a number of times this evening, who was nominated by Dr. Martin Luther King for the Nobel Peace Prize back in 1967, and who's lived a life really embodying engaged Buddhism. Buddhism, the kind of engaging with the suffering of the world, certainly not just concerned about, you know, I need to free myself, I need to be more calm or less stressed, but caring, seeing ourselves in everyone else. But also, think of others. I think I've got a huge admiration, as I'm sure many of you do, for Nelson Mandela, you know, and his struggle with 27 years in prison, in 20 years or so on Robben Island in an 8-foot by 10-foot prison cell, and who was able to transform himself while he was in prison. He changed. He didn't go in there, the person he came out 27 years later, but he was able, through working on himself, to really embody forgiveness and reconciliation. And that played a huge role in the relatively peaceful transition to a multiracial democracy in South Africa. You think of Rosa Parks, who wouldn't go to the back of the bus back in Montgomery, Alabama, back in 1955. And she said, "People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired. But that isn't true. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in. The only tired I was tired of giving in." So all of these as kind of bodhisattvas in our own time, of people who work on themselves, transform their own hearts, love their enemies, and work to resolve conflict and bring harmony. Obviously, think of Dr. Martin Luther King, who said to white segregationists of the 60s, "Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We will still love you. But be assured that we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory." So seeing the enemy as to be loved, you know, to keep our hearts open. And we can think of people who didn't become famous. I think of my mother as a bodhisattva, had 9 children and, you know, tough times on her postal worker's wages, but was always compassionate and selfless. You may think of bodhisattvas in your own life, you know, people you know, friends, family. The wonderful Mary Oliver, the poet, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" That great question, you know, who left us earlier this year, who died earlier this year. Or Mother Teresa, who said, "Not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love." So I think these times are calling on us to be bodhisattvas. In whatever way that might express itself to you, it doesn't have to mean being a political activist, being out on the streets or, you know, calling or getting out the vote. Could be that, but it might be looking after aging parents or serving clients or the community. What does this moment, this time, call on me to do? How might I be a bodhisattva in these times? How might these practices that we've been exploring and working with today help me to open my heart, to engage in the world, and to care about the suffering and wanting to resolve to end suffering? to bring healing to the world. So let's just take a final minute just to sit and hold whatever is present in the body and the heart and the mind. And you might, if you choose to, just reflect on an intention you might connect with as you leave here this evening. Intention, it could just be being kind in to your family or work colleagues, or engaging in some way in the world. Martha Postlethwaite again, do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is yours, alone to sing, falls into your open, cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worthy of rescue. Thank you for your very kind attention this evening. I hope something of what I shared was helpful to you.